Welcome to The Debate. You know, usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of absolute precision. It's almost like engineering.
Mm-hmm.
If you fall and break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line in the bone, and the doctor just points to the screen and says, there it is. That's the problem.
Right. It's binary. It's broken or not broken. It's clean, and honestly, it's comforting. We like things to be visible and easily categorized.
Exactly. But then you step into the world of civilizational systems, right? Planetary ecology, societal collapse. And suddenly, that x-ray machine is completely useless. We're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky.
Yeah, it is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. I mean, we have endless streams of data on climate change, on wealth inequality, institutional decay. But our capacity to actually read the systemic pathology, to see how the diseases actually connect, it feels entirely fragmented.
Which brings us to today's massive question. Can we create a literal grammar for human survival? We are conducting an intellectual examination of Dr. Bechara Saheli's foundational text, The Architecture of Viability. A grammar of coherence for life, mind, society, and planet.
A very ambitious text.
Incredibly ambitious. The text proposes a framework of 7 foundational elements, things like perception, constraint, and margin. So does this viability grammar give us the exact, mathematically closed diagnostic tool we need to heal a collapsing civilization?
Or by trying to map strict biological rules onto human society, are we just creating this rigid, reductive cage that misses the messy reality of human freedom?
Exactly. And to be clear, our discussion today emerges strictly from the provided source material, focusing entirely on its theoretical foundations, structural models, and philosophical implications. I will argue that without this relational closure around what the text calls life capacity, our fragmented models will just continue to drive us towards civilizational pathology.
And I will argue that while those 7 primitives are descriptively brilliant, imposing a strict mathematical closure and treating human institutions as if they are, you know, biological cells, it masks critical complexities and risks a really dangerous over-systematization.
Well, I have to say right up front, I think this viability grammar is exactly the paradigm shift we've been waiting for. We cannot solve what we call the meta crisis with additive thinking.
What do you mean by additive thinking in this context?
I mean, we can't simply slap an ecological metric onto a report here, add a social metric over there, and just hope the whole system suddenly becomes healthy. The text identifies 7 primitives: constraint, margin, state, disturbance, perception, regulation, and options.
Right, the core vocabulary.
Yes, but the true genius here is that these aren't just bullet points on a list. They form an irreducible relational grammar. The text moves us from fragmented systems thinking to true coherence by utilizing a mathematical concept called the Fano plane to create closure. It literally forces us to see how these elements interlock. And crucially, it grounds this entire closed geometry in the concept of life value. This means we prioritize actual breathing life, what the text calls life capacity, over false invariants like money value or, say, institutional self-preservation. Escaping the pathology of our current civilization requires exactly this kind of rigorous closed diagnostic architecture. Without it, we are literally just putting band-aids on symptoms while the patient bleeds out.
I hear you. And I approach this text with immense respect for its synthesis. I mean, it bridges biology, cognition, and governance in a really profound way.
It really does.
And I completely validate the absolute brilliance of identifying those 7 primitives. As a descriptive vocabulary to talk about what's going wrong in the world, it is incredibly powerful. However, I have major red flags when we start demanding mathematical closure and totalizing this across all scales of existence.
You think it's too rigid?
I think mapping these social and planetary crises onto the strict geometry of a Fano plane is an elegant metaphor, but taking it as a literal, minimal geometry for civilizational renewal is dangerous. When we translate concepts that describe biological life, like a single cell's autopoiesis, directly to societal institutions,
we gloss over the fundamental differences between a cell membrane and a nation's borders.
Well, the text doesn't say they are exactly the same thing.
No, and the text itself warns against over-systematizing care, explicitly stating that societies are not literally organisms. But my core concern is that by enforcing this rigid mathematical closure, the framework risks becoming the very kind of technocratic master observer it seeks to critique. It forces the totally unpredictable territory of human freedom into a neat little triadic incidence table.
Let's dive into that right now, because that transition from a mere list of primitives to a functional grammar, that is the beating heart of this text. You mentioned the Fano plane.
Yeah, let's unpack that.
Right, so if you're listening right now and wondering, you know, what on earth is a Fano plane and what does it have to do with society? Think of it like a geometric map with 7 points and 7 lines, where every point connects to 3 lines and every line contains 3 points. It mathematically ensures that no single element can be isolated.
Which sounds great in theory.
But I must defend the absolute necessity of this closure in practice. Think about how we currently diagnose the world. An economist sits at a dashboard and measures gross domestic product. That's the state primitive, right? It tells us how much economic activity is happening.
Sure.
It is a deeply misleading, almost dangerous snapshot if you ignore the margin. Things like topsoil depletion, ecological surplus, or human exhaustion. And you also need to look at the boundaries holding the system together, which is constraint. In the Fano plane, state, margin, and constraint form exactly one of those lines. Triad 1, the geometry of viability.
Right, the foundational triad.
Yes, and you literally cannot isolate these variables without breaking the geometry. The math prevents the epistemic blindness of looking at GDP without forcing you to also look at the ecological margin that was destroyed to create it.
I come at it from a different way, claiming closure rule 1, where every primitive appears in 3 triads, it's mathematically deeply satisfying. It is beautiful projective geometry. But social reality does not neatly arrange itself into perfectly balanced equations.
But it provides a framework to understand it.
Does it? My question is whether this forces reality to fit a model rather than the model reflecting reality. Let's look at another one of those triads. The text says that constraint, perception, and regulation form the governance triad. That is a highly structured claim. But in the messy reality of human politics, what happens when the lines between what constitutes a constraint and what constitutes a perception completely blur?
Give me an example.
Think about a cultural taboo. Is that an actual constraint on behavior, or is it a shared perception of reality? By demanding this strict geometric closure, we risk cutting off the messy, non-linear realities of human social systems that simply don't fit onto the 7 lines of the Fano plane. It borders on a kind of structuralist rigidity that suffocates nuance.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. Think of this geometric closure not as a straitjacket, but as the grammar of a spoken language.
Okay, I'm listening.
The grammar of English or Mandarin does not dictate what you say. It completely avoids totalization in that sense. You are free to utter an infinite number of unique sentences, but the grammar provides the necessary relational rules, the syntax, so that you do not speak gibberish.
Well, the text argues that our civilization is currently speaking systemic gibberish. We talk about expanding our options while actively depleting our margins, like pushing for endless quarterly economic growth while systematically destroying planetary biodiversity. The Fano plane closure doesn't tell a society exactly what laws to pass or how to govern itself. It simply provides the minimal relational syntax required to ensure that the system remains viable. It acts as an alarm bell, pointing out when we are speaking operational nonsense.
Well, that is a very elegant way to frame it. But a grammar is just a tool, right? I mean, a perfectly grammatical sentence can still be a lie. A military bureaucracy can be perfectly grammatical in its operations, perfectly coordinated while executing terrible violence or systemic oppression.
Which brings us to the text's concept of the invariant.
Exactly. For this whole framework not to become a highly efficient dystopia, the grammar must serve something. It needs a true north.
Yes, and that is why the text anchors the entire architecture in what philosopher John McMurtry calls life value ontoaxiology. This is the core invariant. Modern civilization is collapsing precisely because it is organized around false invariants.
Things like GDP,
Exactly. We use money value, capital accumulation, and institutional self-preservation as our core drivers. The text argues that life capacity must be the objective normative anchor. Simply put, life capacity is the ability of living beings and communities to access, maintain, and develop the conditions of life. Breathable air, clean water, communal trust.
Right.
If an economic system consumes its civil commons to produce corporate profit, it might be incredibly organized. It might be what the text calls system coherent, but it is not life coherent. It is pathological. The grammar is only viable if its regulatory mechanisms are working in service of life capacity.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered the epistemic challenge of actually defining life capacity at scale?
How so?
I approach this with intellectual humility, but also firm skepticism. I fully acknowledge that life capacity works beautifully at the cellular or physiological scale. A lack of oxygen is an objective, measurable limit for a human body. But at the civilizational scale, defining what constitutes developmental or cultural life capacity becomes deeply contested territory.
Because of politics?
Exactly. The text draws a sharp distinction between system coherence and life coherence. Assuming that universal human life necessities can be governed polycentrically without elite capture. But who gets to define what cultural practices preserve life capacity and which ones are pathological?
Well, it's not arbitrary.
But the moment we try to scale this biological concept of life value to global governance, we slam into the reality of political power. One group's life-coherent necessity is another group's ideological constraint. It assumes a universality of human flourishing that history tells us is rarely agreed upon.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, honestly, because it ignores how the text biologically grounds the concept of life capacity. It relies heavily on Terence Deacon's theory of teleodynamics. Life capacity isn't just an arbitrary cultural preference that politicians get to vote on. It is rooted in how living systems are fundamentally organized by absence. Deacon's crucial insight is that absence is causal.
Wait, causal absence is a really tough, abstract concept for a lot of people. Walk us through how that actually works in this framework.
Sure. Think about a single-celled organism moving toward a food source. Why does it move? It moves because of a hunger for an absent nutrient gradient. If you are dying of thirst, the absence of water isn't just a philosophical concept, it is a physical force pulling you toward the river.
Okay, so the lack creates the drive.
Exactly. The lack of something is the actual physical force that drives the system's behavior. In this framework, constraint is not a limitation or a tool of elite power. Constraint is a meaning maker that prevents energy from just dissipating randomly. It allows for purpose without needing supernatural intervention.
Right, at the biological level.
But scale that up. What drives a society to revolt? It's not usually what they have. It's the absence of justice. That empty space, that lack, is an actual causal force that moves history. When a society lacks justice or lacks meaning, it is experiencing a causal absence that degrades its viability. The objective reality of that absence is what defines the loss of life capacity. It's not subjective politics, it's the physics of living systems.
But this is exactly where the symbolic scaling breaks down for me. You are taking Deacon's teleodynamics, which brilliantly explains biological purpose and how a cell seeks sugar, and you are stretching it to cover highly abstract social phenomena.
I don't think it's a stretch.
It is, though. Human symbolic absences, like the absence of justice, the absence of meaning, or the absence of historical memory, they operate fundamentally differently than a bacteria missing a nutrient gradient. A nutrient gradient is a physical reality. Justice is a negotiated, languaged, symbolic construct that changes across eras.
But the mechanism of constraint and drive is parallel.
When the text warns that pathology is a misrelation to absence, it is a profound philosophical point, I grant that. But treating complex cultural despair as a mere systemic regulatory failure or a misrelation to absence risks reducing profound human existential and political struggles to biological diagnostic categories. It flattens the rich, unpredictable reality of human freedom into an equation.
I don't believe it flattens it at all. I think it integrates it. And that integration flows directly into Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela's concept of autopoiesis, how living systems literally bring forth a world through their interactions. Now, the text admits a society might not be a single biological cell, but it relies on similar principles like operational closure and structural coupling.
right? The languaging part.
Yes. Maturana defines languaging as the coordination of action. It's how we build a shared reality. Let's use a very modern example. Social media algorithms.
A great example of pathology.
Right? When a society's civil commons of meaning is corrupted by false invariants, like monetizing human attention and outrage for corporate profit, the society literally loses its perceptual primitives. Its languaging breaks down. It can no longer coordinate its actions to solve real problems like climate change. It becomes blind to the absences you just mentioned.
I see the connection you're making.
The biological metaphor is absolutely vital because it shows how a society that cannot perceive its own margin depletion will regulate itself into collapse, exactly like an organism that has lost its sensory perception.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. The text itself contains the exact admission that undermines this direct scaling. It explicitly states, and I quote, "Societies do not autopoietically produce themselves in the same way cells do. A society is not a literal organism."
Yes, I acknowledge that quote.
If we push this biological metaphor too far, we walk right into what anthropologist Joseph Tainter calls the complexity trap. Tainter shows how societies build complexity to solve problems, but eventually suffer diminishing returns. They require more and more hierarchy and elite domination just to maintain the system's structure.
But that's a pathology that Grammer diagnoses.
Hear me out. If we treat human institutions as literally autopoietic, as living things with their own biological imperative for survival, we accidentally justify institutional self-preservation. The bureaucracy starts acting like a cell trying to survive, consuming the margins of the citizens just to maintain its own structure. The text correctly identifies institutional self-preservation as a false invariant, but using the autopoietic metaphor inherently encourages systems to self-reproduce. It gives the bureaucracy a biological excuse to eat the host.
That's an interesting point, though. I would frame it very differently. The text anticipates and completely avoids this complexity trap precisely by making a vital distinction, separating structure from organization. This comes directly from Maturana's biology.
Explain how that prevents the trap.
Think about a modern hospital. A hospital's structure, its concrete buildings, its massive billing departments, its layers of administrators, that structure can persist and try to aggressively self-reproduce, but its life-serving organization, the actual healing of patients, can completely die in the process.
Right. The administration outlives the care.
Exactly. The viability grammar is designed specifically as a diagnostic tool to spot these hollow systems. It is not a justification for the bureaucracy to preserve itself. It is the exact mechanism by which we can point to the hospital and say, your structure is surviving, but your life capacity organization is failing. You are system coherent, but life incoherent. The grammar gives us the vocabulary to dismantle the complexity trap by showing us exactly when complexity is serving the elite structure rather than the civil commons.
Okay, but does it give us the political mechanism to dismantle it? Or just a highly sophisticated diagnostic dashboard? My concern remains that this entire architecture provides a profoundly complex map of the metacrisis. It successfully names the coupled regulatory failures, you know, showing how the climate crisis, the meaning crisis, and the public health crises are all deeply intertwined failures of perception and regulation.
Which is a massive achievement.
It is. But a map is not the territory. By enforcing mathematical closure through the faunal plane and by stretching biological teleodynamics to explain social phenomena, we risk creating a totalizing framework. It is a brilliant heuristic, but we must treat it strictly as a heuristic, not an absolute universal geometry, lest it obscure the unpredictable, messy, and unsystematizable reality of human political contestation.
And yet, without that primary cut, without those seven primitives explicitly closed around the invariant of life capacity, we remain entirely blind to the root causes of the metacrisis. We will just keep applying additive solutions, a carbon tax here, a mindfulness app there, while the underlying grammar of our civilization continues to produce pathology. The architecture Dr. Sahali provides is not a rigid cage. It is the vital non-reductive vocabulary we desperately need to move from fragmented data points to coherent civilizational renewal. Well, we certainly find convergence there. whatever our theoretical disagreements on the rigidity of the Fano plane geometry or the limits of scaling autopoiesis to the state level, we absolutely agree on the text's core warning. Yeah.
A civilization that prioritizes money value over life value, that blindly consumes its ecological and social margins to maximize its present state, and that corrupts its languaging so it can no longer perceive its own decay, is on a definitive path to systemic collapse.
Exactly. Holding these multiple perspectives simultaneously is where the real value lies. The grammar of viability doesn't hand us easy utopian answers, but it forces us to continuously question what it is we are actually preserving when we govern.
Absolutely.
There is immense depth left to explore in this material, especially regarding its practical applications in medicine, ecology, and governance. But for now, we return to that broken X-ray machine. The waters of civilizational collapse are incredibly murky, but with the right grammar, we can finally start to read the shadows.